This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together and give a very, very warm welcome to Mr. Simon Reeve and Paul Blizzard.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming. Morning.
Very good afternoon, everybody. Are you enjoying the show? Have you booked your holidays? Who's going to Malawi? Who's going to the Tropic of Cancer? Who's going to visit a sacred river? How many of you have seen Simon on your TV screens in your
homes? Come on. You don't have to have.
Couple of hands up.
Couple.
Yeah, they're going up now. He needs to be a hero today. I'm going to let you into a secret. For the first time ever, Simon's son, Jake, is in the audience, seeing what his dad does that buys the toys. So we need to make Simon look like an absolute hero to his son today. So could you please give a huge welcome to Simon Reeve?
Yay!
There's something really interesting about your career, Simon, which I really love, which is you start off as a writer, so you're partly travel writer, but what you are brilliant at doing is not only finding stories from the places that you go to, but getting them through that two-dimensional screen in our rooms and making us think we're there. Can you talk to us a little bit about when you're doing the pieces to camera with great backdrops or whatever it is, what's going through your head to think, how can I tell this story in a way that somebody sitting on their sofa can see it and it can become lively? Because, of course, being traveling is not just about what we see, it's about what we smell, what we hear, feet in the sand or watching the river, all that. It's all the non-visual stuff that TV doesn't really convey. Can you work us through that?
A little bit, perhaps. Interesting. I mean, nice for you to say I started as a writer. I started as a postboy. Yeah. And I started at the very bottom on a newspaper, properly sorting the post, 18. And I think that led gradually on. I went from that to being a junior researcher, brackets, home news. And then I was a sort of junior writer, brackets, underpaid, et cetera, et cetera. But the point was I started at the absolute bottom. And I started with writing tiny, tiny articles, and what are called nibs, news in briefs in newspapers. Those just sort of one paragraphs. And actually, you know, I don't have a degree. I don't have hardly any qualifications at all, quite frankly, to do this job. Not that many seem to be required. But I think the way I started, it taught me in some way, perhaps, how to structure stories, at least on the page, if not now with you. But what that gave me, I suppose, was a little bit of a sense of how to tell a tale on TV. Writing, I suppose one of the great surprises to me was writing for television, making a television program, is not hugely dissimilar to the structure that you require when you're writing a book. You're basically sort of bringing in all of this information, and then you've got to assemble it into a structure that's going to stay vaguely interesting to the reader. But obviously you want to get your points across. I suppose when we're making the telly programs, the key for us is, how would I explain this to mate in the pub? How would I explain this to my family with their short attention spans? You know, that's what you're always thinking. But it's not just telling a tale. As you say, you've got to try and convey something of the travel. But in fairness, that's not just that's not just my job. That's just not just what I do. I would argue that the camera and our cameramen perform that duty magnificently. They're the ones pulling in and sucking in those incredible images from around planet Earth. And to be honest, you know, they're the ones who get up to film the sunrise. They're the ones who stay up. Craig, he's always staying up to shoot a moonshot in the middle of the night after he's worked a 12-hour day. You know, that takes effort and commitment and dedication. So we're a team on this. And yes, obviously, I've got a fundamental role in making the programs, but great. I am part of a team.
Talk to us, because most people travel because they get a holiday for 2 or 3 weeks that they've worked the rest of the year to be able to afford. You have a
Thank you for reminding me of that. Yes, I know.
You get to do it as a job. So
yes, on their license fee. I know,
paid for by the license fee. Exactly. Very honest of you. one of the things that always surprised me about really good travel presenters and really good travel writers is that they maintain the passion for the places that they go to. There's no sense of them being jaded. It's like, oh, not yet another beautiful Caribbean beach, or not yet another fantastic swim in the, you know, or snorkeling over the reefs in the Seychelles or the Maldives. Yeah. Do you ever get jaded? And if not, how do you sustain the love? How do you sustain the passion?
I think if you do start getting jaded, particularly when these lovely folk are paying for it, you need to be off the screens and doing something else. You know, they're, as a team, whether we're somewhere extraordinary or we're somewhere very difficult, there are a lot of times, genuinely, there are a lot of times when we will pinch each other and say, I can't believe we are getting to do this. We are very conscious of the privilege of doing it. So, and I think that's really important. That is a fundamental part of stopping you being jaded, is you say, oh goodness, you know, I just can't face another beautiful turquoise sea. Oh dear. Or it wasn't as good as this in the Maldives or whatever. You know, there is that risk. But I think, you know, I've got a very short memory, a very bad memory. That probably helps. So I sometimes forget. I'm a little bit like the goldfish going around in the bowl. I think I know how lucky I am, and people around me are constantly reminding me of that. You know, I don't come from a privileged background. I don't come from a travel-y family. I didn't get on a plane until I started working. And I do think that's part of it. You know, I think not expecting to do this job or to have this this privilege is helpful. It means that you know, I wake up in the morning, wherever it is, whether it's a hut or a hotel, and I try and embrace that day. And you know, the gig I've got, we are moving on almost every day. Okay, yep. If somebody's had the time to hang their shirts up in a cupboard, then I know we've been in that place for too long. Normally, it's almost every night we're moving on. Quite. And frankly, when the world is as amazing as it is, you would have to have a stony heart to really not be buoyed and amazed and inspired by it. You know, I get to meet incredible people. I do get to see extraordinary sights, as I'm going on about on the telly all the time. Wow, wow, it's genuine. You know, it is an incredible world. And I try and just reflect that and get a little bit across of that daft passion, perhaps, on the programmes.
Can we go to come to something a little bit more personal? Shed the light on how this got started. You know, no qualifications for this job, didn't go to university. How did you break in, one, to TV presenting, and two, travel presenting?
Did I want to do TV presenting?
Yeah, how did you get
into it? You'd have to be bonkers to sort of think you could, I want to be a TV presenter. I think, I mean, there are people who've done that, but generally anyway, people have been asked to do it, or they've done something which has led to them coming to the attention of the BBC, and the BBC's, do you want to get involved in making programmes, et cetera, et cetera. All right, well, my route was a slightly odd one. I didn't go to public school, and I wasn't in the army. Those seem to be useful qualifications for being a telepresenter nowadays.
Great.
I started, as I say, as a postboy in a newspaper. I went to a perfectly nice but ordinary school in West London. I was a very crappy student, didn't study enough, drank a bit too much, didn't apply myself to the task at hand. And I was a bit rebellious and contrary and had a few legal run-ins, etc. And yet still, after a year on the dole, which was a very depressing time of my life, I mean, I sort of hit rock bottom at various points, you know, when I thought, I am not going to be able to do anything in my life. And you know, I can't remember if I told you this the other day, and I'm sorry if I did.
Even
sorrier to you if you've heard me tell this before. But, you know, there was a point when I was about 18, and I went for a job as a white van driver on Wembley Park Trading Estate, and they did not give me the job, even though I was the only person who applied. I mean, that is bounce, bounce, bounce. And I really did. What I remember just being walking out of that chat, it wasn't even an interview, and you know you feel low at that point.
Great.
No idea what I was going to do in life. And then my dad, eventually, after I was on the dole and I had that whole utterly depressing period of life, Dad saw an ad in the paper for a postboy, and I applied and got it. And my world opened up. You know, I was suddenly in an environment where people were being asked to do mad stuff. My big break eventually was going and tracking down two South African nutter terrorists who were on the run in this country. And I did that, no health and safety concerns whatsoever. Simon, you're 18, just go and find these two people who'd blown up queues of people waiting for taxi ranks in South Africa. They've been trying to destabilize the peace process there. Mad. And I found them. And that sort of led me into specializing in investigating terrorism, rather bizarrely. I'm trying to cut the long story. I'm sorry. I left the newspaper eventually, and I wrote books. I wrote several books, number of books, in fact, but one in particular about Al-Qaeda and bin Laden that came out in 98. Nobody took any notice. Nobody took any interest in it. Mum and Dad went around bookstores, moving it from the back to the front of the shop and blowing the dust off it. And then 9/11 happened. And I'd written the only book in the world, and I was a kid from London, but obviously I was pushed onto the telly to talk about this. And
the only book on Osama bin Laden.
It's not hugely surprising. My phone started ringing before the second tower had been hit, and it didn't stop for more than a year. And it was... obviously I'd spent a lot of time in the towers. My book had started out as an investigation of the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, which I don't know if you remember.
I do.
And I started investigating that the same day it happened. And 5 years, it took 5 years of research, my goodness. And a bizarre and incredible time, and weird things happened, you know. And I was a kid from, and I was being given top secret information by Pakistani intelligence and meeting militants and having extraordinary, terrifying experiences with these guys. One situation where, you know, I was in a room and they were debating killing me. You know, just mad things what happened, and very terrifying looking back on it. But yeah, I wrote a book. Nobody read it. 9/11 happened. It became a bestseller, and the BBC started saying, "You've got your own hair and teeth. let's work on TV."
Talk us through...
It's very shallow TV, very shallow.
Let's do this then, because we've all seen you in front of camera with fantastic backdrops. Talk us through what goes on the other side of the camera, how the day works when you have planned the series, whether it's Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn, Sacred Rivers, or you're doing Around the Equator. All the planning's gone on in Broadcasting House. You know what you're going, and then you jump on the plane, you're there, you land. What happens? Who is it? A big team? Are there hundreds of you, 20s of you?
I think those days have passed in TV, but it wasn't long ago. Yeah, people would be followed by a mule with a crate of champagne, wouldn't they? But no, four of us generally travel out, including me. There's an assistant producer who also shoots, which on several of the journeys was my wife. Thank you, Anya, over there. We've got a producer-director who carries the can if anything goes wrong, and we've got a cameraman who basically really, really grafts and bleeds for the programmes.
Correct.
14 kilos on the shoulder for day after day while I do this. We arrive somewhere, we take a deep breath, we look at what our plan is, and it is really just a rough plan. Go to location A, film something about, and make it up as you go along. We don't have a script. Nobody really does a recce. Nobody goes and does the journey before me and works out where I'm going to stand and what I'm going to say. Thank goodness, because that would be very, very boring if they did. For us, frankly, you know, it's all preordained almost, right? Oh, no, sorry, it doesn't say that in the script. No, we are required to make it up as we go along and be spontaneous where we can. We do have a plan, however, a rough plan, because frankly, it would be a little bit unacceptable for us just to waft in and think, let's sit down for a couple of days in this lovely place and work out how we're going to spend your dosh. It's expensive making TV. Cameras cost a lot. Cameramen are not cheap as well. So, you know, we have to have an idea, but we do basically make it up as we go along.
So how do you go about finding the people that you interview? I mean, is that just fortuitous happenstance when you're in country?
It's a bit of everything. We'll talk to people in advance, and we'll try and find out. So who's a great character among the Coggy people of the Sierra Nevada mountains in Colombia, for example? But as you can imagine, establishing from London who is a good character among the Coggy people is a little bit tricky. So often we arrive somewhere, and somebody's been put forward to talk to us because they've met some white folk before. It's not like they've done the full media course, but they've, you know, they've had encounters with the outside world, and they'll be pushed in, and they're basically 70, and they talk extremely slowly, and they talk in a flowery way that just won't quite translate onto TV. And behind them hiding is a slightly more excitable younger person. Then we've got to deal with the diplomatic repercussions of saying to the chief, "Dear chief, would you mind letting us talk with your friend here?" And that's sometimes where what we'll do. Sometimes when in that situation, we'll have a second camera going, and the producer will, the PD will say they've got to interview the chief over here, and we'll say, I shouldn't tell you this, but we have a code, and we'll say, I think we might need the magenta filter for that little chat. Obviously, that is a code for don't even bother turning the camera on, but just hold it up, you know. And then they'll stand over there, and then they've got to talk to that person while we take younger person away and try and film them. But that does frankly make it more interesting and a bit more dynamic for us. It does sometimes result in disaster when the chief says, "Oh no, in our culture, only I can talk to you," and then we all have that sinking feeling where we think this might not make it onto telly. So there's some advantages from a recce, but I prefer the dynamism of making it up.
What's the ratio of stuff you shoot compared to stuff we see?
Oh, goodness.
Oh, is it that bad?
Well, it sounds sort of ridiculous. You know, I mean, we film some shoots now. We've got 5 or 6 cameras that are filming. We can film on that are broadcast quality. And that's down now to these little GoPros that I'm sure some of you have got or used. You know, that's a broadcast quality little device now. So we'll have 3 of those maybe that the cameramen love plonking on things and putting in chest harnesses. And you just get this ludicrous amount of footage as a result. So we might have 40 hours on the main camera. We might have another 100 hours from all the other devices. And, you know, that's got to be assembled and then just a little, this 1 hour here.
Wow.
That's quite depressing in a way that it's chopped down. But obviously our argument would be that quantity provides a degree of quality.
And the flexibility when you're editing to actually work out what the story is.
Yeah, and, you know, and how it's particularly changed from how you planned it. There's 4 of us. We turn up somewhere and we've got to film that as best we possibly can in the 2 hours before the light goes. You know, we really need several cameras rolling because we'll get back and somebody will say, oh, you know, I will say, there's a couple more things I'd like to say over that situation. Please, can we have an extra 5 seconds of shots there? You know, if we haven't got the shots, then that becomes tricky. So credit to the team because they're the ones filming it, obviously, while I'm just doing this.
Quite. One of the things that comes across from the shows that you've made is that you're not just showing the pretty shots, the beaches, the palm trees, you know, the beautiful architecture, but also you kind of lift the veil on the destinations that you go to and show us behind the scenes. Why is that important to you? Why is it important to us, the viewer?
Well, obviously, I appreciate you identifying that because I think that's a sort of fundamental part of the programs I've made.
Yeah.
And obviously, I come to this having written books, and obviously I tend to trade my entire life off being an author, as it were. But I think there was a feeling from the outset that I wasn't a celeb at all. I was coming it more from the perspective of a writer, of a journo, of an investigator, if you like. So it was always the idea that we would incorporate shade as well as light. And although we don't have a template, we don't have an algorithm we use, I suppose we do try and tell the viewers, as I started to say there, something that's a little bit contrary, perhaps something that they might not know. Obviously, we're always trying to come up with is another of these terrible telly terms, but they always say, we're going to give them water cooler facts. You know, not on my proposals, I hasten to add, but this is the sort of language telly people use. And that's when everybody's standing around the water cooler at in the office the next day talking about, oh, I saw something on the telly. You know, that's the society we've gone from. It's gone from standing at the bar facts to water cooler facts. Anyway, so in a beautiful country, we'll look for a bit of that shade.
Yeah.
We might start looking for problems. So Rubbish Island in the Maldives, which is one place we filmed, and vice versa, you know, in Haiti, for example, which has a pretty bad rep but is a very beautiful country. We went to some really spectacular places there, really beautiful places, and try and flip round what our general stereotype is. So that was the idea from the outset. I don't think really that the BBC could justify now spending your licence fee sending some puffed up, overpaid celeb to go and look at some nice hotels and say, oh, there's a lovely beach over there. That's not my gig. I personally don't want to watch that on TV. I think we've all got the opportunity to do that. And, you know, companies here will give you a brochure for that and probably a DVD as well. So I think our responsibility, if you like, is to try and take you to places that people haven't necessarily gone to before or try and tell stories they haven't heard before. That's how I would see, in some way, my gig.
Working for the BBC must be kind of hard, though, because there are so many really good travel presenters. And I'm kind of intrigued. You know who I'm going to name, don't you? I'm kind of trying to work out how you divvy up the globe. Do you get the crumbs from Michael Palin's table? Is that
I said
works?
That the other day. You've nicked that from me.
I have, yes.
I'm happy. I would be. That's not a bad job in life, really, to get the crumbs from Lord Palin's table. It was a lovely bloke, of course. When I'm thinking of the projects I'm interested in doing, and I don't get a free pass from the BBC, and nor does Michael Palin, I'm sure. But when I'm coming up with an idea, and I've come up with about three quarters of the ideas I've done, or two-thirds of the ideas I've done, I've got to think, has Michael Palin been here before? Is this part of the world I'm going to be allowed to travel with around? And those are sort of considerations. Yes, you do have to think, what are people going to want to watch?
Right.
That's not our guiding only priority. The BBC isn't entirely driven by ratings. But I could not, I would have thought, make a TV series about the Urals, for example, called The Urals, partly because it does not sound very inviting, even though it would be a fascinating journey. I've got to come up with stuff that will draw people's eyeballs in. Because not you lot, you're all lovely, but basically TV viewers in this country, they are quite a fickle bunch. And as they're flicking through at 8 or 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, and there's, you know, Strictly or Downton Abbey, which I've been put up against. Who has put us up against Downton Abbey? You know, you've got to come up with something that's going to encourage them to watch. Great. The Urals? Probably not. Indian Ocean? Maybe. Caribbean? Possibly.
Do you want to talk about Caribbean? Are we allowed to?
Of course I do. That's my job.
Do you want a sneak preview of what he's been doing for the last few months? When did you get back, and what were you doing in the Caribbean?
He's got a moment now. He's getting his cue. He's got to press the button. All right, so before he starts encouraging you to hate me for it, I've got a new telly series coming out in a couple of months. I'm sorry about it. I apologise in advance. It's called Caribbean. It was a jolly gig. It wasn't just a jolly, though. It was amazing to do. It's an incredible region. Of course it is. In my humble defence, I would say we do try and have a bit of the shade in as well. And it is more than just a couple of lovely islands, although they are in it as well. But the idea was I go round the edge. I went round the edge of the Caribbean Sea. So small area on here, but 1 million square miles in reality. And I started in Hispaniola. Anyone been to Hispaniola? I'm sure you all know what it is. It's the island Dominican Republic and Haiti's on. Start there, went clockwise round the Caribbean, through some of the islands, and then up the mainland coast of the Caribbean. So through Venezuela, Colombia, into Nicaragua, Honduras, and then finished in Jamaica. So as well as diving on beautiful reef and, you know, doing jolly things like that, we also went into the gangway of a Honduran prison in the most dangerous city in the world. Don't listen, Jake. And hairs are going up on my arm remembering this. And met some of the scariest people I've encountered on planet Earth. So this is a little trailer for the Caribbean Wonders of Technology. Wonder of the Caribbean now.
Here's the temperature.
Thank you.
I'm on a journey around the Caribbean Sea with its thousands of beautiful islands.
And an incredible mainland coast, home to millions of extraordinary people.
This is a vast area with a rich and brutal history.
We're doing good.
Some of the most dangerous places on the planet.
It's one of the most vibrant and exciting regions on Earth.
It's the Caribbean.
On this first leg of my journey, I travel east across the Caribbean Sea. From the island of Hispaniola to the American territory of Puerto Rico. In the Dominican Republic, I'm picked up by the officers battling drug pushers and cartels.
That is a block of cocaine.
I come face to face with the reality of living in America's backyard.
Quite peaceful and still down there, apart from this massive bomb.
I cross one of the poorest countries in the world and get a warm welcome at a voodoo ceremony.
And this is a real treasure of Haiti.
They said they'd give me a tan. They promised me I wouldn't look quite that flipping pasty on the telly.
obviously a fantastic trip and one of the most fascinating parts of the world. we all know about the, you know, the fantastic beaches and palm trees and the hotels and stuff. Talk us through the jail bit. I'm intrigued how that came about, why you did it, and what happened.
Yes.
You happy to talk about it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was I mean, what's incredible for me about these journeys is the utter extremes that we experience and sometimes endure, you know. One day in Honduras, we were diving on beautiful coral reef and helping scientists take samples from parrotfish and talking about the preservation of life in our oceans. And then we went to the mainland of Honduras. I'm sure people here have been then to a place called San Pedro Sula, which is now the most, most dangerous city in the world outside of a war zone. And we were trying to find a way of illustrating the fundamental madness of this place and what's happened there and why it is in such a bad way. And it's partly because of its largely because of its location. You know, it's on the major smuggling route, taking drugs through to the United States. It's essentially, in many ways, American demand for drugs that has helped to destroy this country. It's also weak governance and rubbish in corrupt police, etc. Anyway, but there's a lot of enormous gang problem there. And we were actually there when two policemen were executed, were assassinated. They were they were local cops, and they were machine gunned as they were driving home from work. And we raced to the scene in a mad sort of situation. It was the day after we'd been diving on the reef, and it involved driving the wrong way down a motorway. It was this crazy situation. We got there, and these two cops had been killed. There was only one other guy with a camera there. And that's an incredible thing on planet Earth. It's such a normal event there, a murder an hour. A murder rate in that city, 180 times the murder rate in London. Terrifying. Anyway, to try and explain that a bit, went into the jail to meet the gang leaders, and we went on to the MS-13, I don't know if people know what that is, the most fearsome gang in the Americas, really, to meet these just terrifying people with all of the Hollywood gang tattoos that you imagine, covered in tears down here, indicating how many people they've killed, people who've skinned people. And what was utterly surreal, and it's very hard to convey the madness of these situations on telly, was that the main gang leader that I was trying to talk to, he really wanted to show us on the MS-13 gang wing the nativity scene they had been making from recycled objects, and they'd been making it for the Honduran prison nativity scene competition, and a guy was turning up the next day to judge their nativity scene.
Extraordinary.
And it's just beyond your wildest imaginings, frankly. And there were guys there who were the tats, and they're the this, and they're, you know, very scary. And then you start talking to them, and you know they were friendly and hospitable and brought us chairs and got us soft drinks from their shop that they've got there. No guards, they run it themselves. We had to go in with the bishop of the city as protection for us. I can't tell you how mad this is. It's an utterly overwhelmingly bizarre place.
Do you ever get scared traveling? Because it's not all fun. Well, of course that's scary, but you've also, I mean, was it the equator series? You got malaria. You caught malaria. You were very ill.
Yeah, although when I got it, I was quite relieved to be told it was malaria because we'd just been in an Ebola zone. And in the middle of the night, I was like vomiting blood. And I thought that, you know, I thought it was Ebola. Ludicrous as it is, I was slightly relieved to find it was malaria. I was a white telepresenter in Africa. You know, I was able to get treatment. It's still something that holds that continent back.
Great.
And of course, there's not enough research into it because most white folk don't get it. And we wiped it out in Europe a while ago. A few decades ago, anyway, it was still a problem in Italy until quite recently. I get scared, not so much in those situations. I feel scared for me and the team when when I've led them into something that I then think we really shouldn't be here. And, you know, as an example, I was filming the Indian Ocean series. We just started the journey. We were filming something about the connection between our ocean and drugs in South Africa, without going into the long story. And we were in a township near Cape Town, and somebody said to us, why don't you go and talk to the crazy guy over there? And I, you know, I'm the one on camera, I'm sort of leading the show.
Sure.
And I say, yes, all right, let's go and see him. And I took the team in to meet the crazy guy. And as we're walking into his house, I realized it was the drug den of the local gang, and they were all off their heads. And I started to panic for my team a bit because I've got two guys behind me. It was Jonathan and Andrew in that case. Jonathan is filming, and all he's just looking through here, you know, that's his focus, keeping the bloviating presenter in there. Yeah, he doesn't see the full spectrum. And then I've got Andrew behind, who's supposed to to be keeping an eye on Jonathan and making sure he doesn't trip and holding a sound boom. And I'm the sort of point man in that situation. And, you know, it's a scary, scary moment. I worry for them as much as anything.
Great. Show us this flask. Why have you got this flask? Let's talk about it, because there's a big emphasis on ecotourism, though. I'm sure we all know the old adage, you know, take nothing but photos, leave nothing but footprints. But one of the things that you're interested in is about how we should travel responsibly. So this is a really good little sort of metaphor for it. Why a metal flask?
I've got a footprint, just ludicrous environmental footprint, obviously the size of a town in the developing world, of course. That's just a little pathetic thing I do to try and reduce down the amount of plastic bottles I end up carrying and using. And obviously, you know, when we're in the middle of nowhere, we need a water supply. I've got another stainless steel filter bottle that I try and use as much as I can, that you just put the water into. You can take it from a river or a hotel or wherever, yeah. And it will filter out all the nastiness. And I think it's probably healthier than using bottled water that's been sitting in 50-degree heat for 4.5 years. As I said, a crazy environmental footprint. I think we're all aware of the consequences, the impacts of our journeys. I know you're all wonderfully thoughtful travellers. I used to feel that there were two, in some ways, maybe 10 years ago, I had a more negative perception of travel. Now, I think I have a view of travel that we are, in some cases, as travellers, the last hope, in many ways, of protecting some of our most iconic creatures on this planet. Now, why is that? Because we go to national parks around the world and marine protected areas, which are basically national parks in the sea, which are rapidly becoming wildlife arcs, which are rapidly becoming our last hope of protecting iconic creatures on planet Earth. And if we don't go to those places, they will log them, they will clear fell them and turn them into palm oil plantations. They will wipe out life in them, or they will fish them to death. Because us going there and paying our little entrance fee as travellers means there is an economic incentive to keep them going. It means there is petrol for the boats, for the engines of the boats, which the gamekeepers or the park wardens or the guards and the soldiers use to protect those areas. We pay the salaries of the rangers. So if we don't go there, we're going to lose these areas. Yes, of course. Burning plane fuel is not a good thing, but you know, our impact is daily, hourly. Everything we do, everything we are, has an impact on the planet. When we're on our journeys, do the right thing. Spend your money wisely. Don't give it to the son of the local dictator. Put it into local people's hands. Buy food from locals. Eat in local restaurants. Go to the national parks and spend your money there. And just open your eyes to the reality in the places you're visiting. It makes for a much better journey. I know you know this, sorry. I know you all know this, but it really does tell people. It makes for such a more interesting journey and experience for you when you're spending your hard-earned money. For God's sake, don't sit by the swimming pool with your earplugs in. You can do that, you know, you can do that at home and for when you're too old to walk. When you've got beating soul, get out there and experience life. It's the most exciting thing to do, to take up these people up on these incredible adventures. Enjoy it as much as you can and get out of your comfort zone. Sorry,
no,
bit of a rant. Apologies.
You gave a...
you're too kind, sir. Thank you.
You have nothing to apologise for. At some point in the past...
And a steel water bottle, you know, it's a small thing.
I've heard you say at some point in the past that we've reached a tipping point now where the fences that protect game reserves, which used to be to keep the animals in, are actually now almost there to keep us out.
Yeah, they absolutely are. They're fencing African parks now, as you say, to keep us out, not animals in.
Do you know what you're doing next? I mean, obviously, Caribbean, I would imagine you're in post-production, doing editing, all that sort of stuff. Do you have a plan for where you're going next?
I don't know what I'm going to do next, and I don't know what I'm going to be allowed or asked to do next. I'm sort of in discussions, as any freelance will tell you. You know, you've got to try and set things up to pay the mortgage. You know, I've got a fairly good gig, and if they'll let me keep doing it, then I will. The Caribbean series won't be out for a couple of months, and we're still working on that. I'm doing the voice record for the second program tomorrow. We've spent a week or so on and off batting a script back and forward. We do it as a team. It's mainly, I suppose, my voice in it. But I, we work as a tight unit,
yeah.
And we argue and row and debate and agree eventually on what I'm allowed to say. And I'm hoping I can sneak the word Muppet into the script I'm doing tomorrow. If you hear me say it in the second Caribbean program about one of the governments that we encounter on the journey, I will be impressed if I get away with that one, but we'll see.
I doubt the BBC legals will allow you to do that. But
well, you can probably get away with it for a government. Government can't really sue, and I think the evidence is pretty strong, quite frankly.
You're a family man. You've got wife and young son here. Where do you go on holiday?
Well, they've gone now, so I can say wherever the wife wants to go, to be honest. We used to work together. I wouldn't meet through work, but she'd worked on wildlife documentaries, and I sort of strong-armed her into working on our programs. And she travelled a lot on... I did a series travel around the Tropic of Cancer, which was one of the toughest gigs I've had, and was one of the absolute strongest members of the team, frankly. While the rest of us were whining about our journey across the Sahara, she was out cleaning the windows on the car so we had a good view and generally keeping us going. So, you know, she's now looking after our big man, and so she doesn't get to travel. So I think she gets to choose. So she's obsessed slightly with Denmark, understandably. Right. She's half Danish. We go there a fair bit to see the in-laws. And she's also obsessed with Greece, which she's been going to since she was a youngster, and she speaks fluent Greek. Right. And we go to an island called Simi. Anyone been to Simi? Off-road. Oh, yes, a little hand-waving there. I'm glad my peripheral vision still works. I spotted you. It's a beautiful island. I think it's got the finest harbour in Greece. So we can all go further and farther, of course, but there's treasures close to home as well. So that's where we go. We don't have really done long haul yet, I think partly because our lad is three still isn't very interested in sitting on a plane for 12 hours.
Right.
But I do want to take him. I want to go and, frankly, I'd love to spend a few months living... in somewhere like Bangladesh with him. Quite. So he can see there are parts of the world where fresh water doesn't necessarily come from the tap. Love Bangladesh, slightly obsessed with there. And I'd love to show him that aspect of life as well.
Good thing to do. Good thing for all of us to do. There are so many of you here. Let's give you a chance to fire your own questions at
Simon.
We don't
have to. Oh,
we have a couple of roving mics. So we'll start with the gentleman there in green, second row, if that's possible. And then the second microphone, who's over here? Can we go to the lady at the back over there with her hand up?
Thank you.
Can you manage that? Thank you very much.
I'm actually interested in how you got interested in and ultimately wrote a best-selling novel on the Munich Olympics.
Okay. All right, right, for as simple as that. Okay. So, yes, I wrote a book about the Munich Olympics massacre in 1972. That came about, it's taken me back a while there. It's non-fiction. It's designed to be... I wrote it in a novelistic way, if you like, but I try and stay as close to the events as possible. And that came about because I'd written a book before that on Al-Qaeda. I specialised in terrorism. And I can't remember who came to who first, but I started talking to some filmmakers about events, if you like, that could be told as a book. So, for example, the Iranian embassy siege, that was one we considered. Then they started talking about doing the Munich Olympics. I had some contacts. They had more contacts. I went off and started working on something else. And they worked up what became a documentary movie. And I started eventually working on the book in parallel with them. The movie won the Oscar for best documentary. It was an incredible film. And I wrote the book as well. And it was a long process, but I was able to use their research. And that was hugely beneficial to me because researching something like that is very, very expensive. So it was sort of parasitical, really. I fed off their research. Thanks for that. Thanks for knowing that.
Lady at the back.
Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to know your opinion. In sort of countries where there's questionable human rights and sort of questionable political frameworks, when we're flocking there as tourists, are we acting to help maybe open up the country and to help bring good things into it? Or actually, are we just strengthening the political, incumbent political parties?
Is your view the latter?
I don't know. I've just come back from Vietnam.
Right.
And at times I felt part of something quite bad.
Okay. Well, that's not a nice tourist feeling to have when you spent a lot of your own dosh, is it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I had a great time. But,
good.
But it was great.
I think it's a bit of both, frankly, as so many things. It's in the grey. You know, you can go to Vietnam, I'm sure. And I think I've been there as well. And no doubt you will start to question who owns the boutique eco hotel you're in and how they got the permits for that in the first place. And oh dear, they seem to have cleared quite a lot of forest to make this eco hotel. No, there's questions about that, definitely. I think that's the case everywhere, though. You know, it's just about timing almost. You go and stay in a boutique eco place here, it's probably on forest that we chopped down 500 years ago. I mean, it's a simplistic point, but you know, countries are going through, there are many countries that are going through a difficult time. They're transitioning in some way, we hope, from being repressive to being more open and transparent. What's happened in Burma recently is incredible. I was in Burma a few years back in an area where there was a lot of oppression. We deliberately went in there because we wanted to see that aspect of life there rather than going to the touristy places. Yeah. I think you've got to be careful how you spend your money.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not asking you to feel super guilty about if you can't put every penny into a local person's pocket. I don't think you're necessarily propping up a regime if you go to a dodgy place. I think you're doing, I think you can engage with locals. You can ask them how they feel. You can talk to them. It's really up to you as the individual traveller to try and move your journey towards a more positive one than a one that has negative consequences. It's a massive question requiring a much longer answer than I can hope to give, and the sort of thoughts are tumbling out. But I think the main thing is up, there is a degree of responsibility on you, if you know it's a bit dodgy, to try and keep yourself away from that and look for the reality and take that home to tell people about as well. If you feel strongly about it, you know, you've never had a better time, a better chance than be able to share it with other people. You know, you can film something on your phone now and put it on the internet for folk to see. So that's a power to you as well as a responsibility for others, I would say.
Are there any no-go countries that you have, or is everything open? Everything's open to options. It's a question of how you do it rather than whether you do it.
I think it probably is for us as telemakers. We would claim that we've got a justification to go anywhere if our motive is true and pure, if you like, and if we're going to try and tell a balanced story about the place. You know, we are. I think we do what you would want us to do. You know, we debate and we argue and we question whether we're saying and doing the right thing. I don't think we've always got that right. I think probably sometimes there was one time I was a bit too hard on Cuba, for example. Yeah. But there was another time where I gave Cuba a bit of an easy ride.
Right.
You know, so I think in the overall balance of the BBC's output, we also consider that. If somebody else has been a bit, oh, it's all lovely here, then we might try and show you a slightly tougher side. In Madagascar, for example, there's been some glossy stuff made about there, and we deliberately set out to show you, actually, folks, it's not all great here. This place is taking a hammering.
Holidays in the Regime would be a good series title. Start in North Korea.
We did a series, there was a strand, as they call it on telly, called Holidays in the Danger Zone,
exactly.
A colleague of mine has done exactly that. But yeah, it'd be good to, I'd love to go there, yeah.
Great. Gentleman in the blue shirt, I don't know who's the closest to him.
Yes, you go.
Lob it over.
And then Zoe, there's a gentleman down here next, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you. So we'll start with you, sir, please.
Hi, Simon.
Hello.
When you make your wonderful programmes, do you go to the BBC with a pitch and say, look, it'll cost you X million pounds for me to make this programme? Or do they come to you and say, here's a pot of money, go make it and come back and see us?
We've got 20 grand, go make it.
Well, whatever, yeah.
When I make my wonderful thank you, sir. To be honest, we're very careful about how we spend the money, and it's always done within a budget. And, you know, the first programmes I made, we were going to some really, really cold places, and I was told I was allowed to buy a bit of cold weather clothing. And then at the end of it, they literally came round with a clipboard and said, where are these socks that you bought? And they made me give back the socks I had bought on the budget. And, you know, I thought it was a bit odd, frankly. I washed them and they went back into the cupboard for some other poor mug to wear. But you kind of want that, don't you, when you're stumping up for the license fee? So money isn't the principal concern. So nobody says, oh, you couldn't do that, even though it's really important, because it would cost too much. But they would work out how we could do it within a financial framework that we would say is acceptable. I don't deal with the money side. I'm the ponce in front of the camera who just comes up with the highfalutin idea, and then somebody else has to cost it and work out how it's going to go. Normally poor old Phil who has to tot up the figures. But nobody sits there and has ever said, you cannot do that important story because it will cost too much. And I think that's the right approach. But it does mean when we say, oh, could we get a beautiful helicopter shots of that location? They go, no, we're going to call somebody up and see if we can get them for free from the tourist board or something like that. I think that's right, frankly. Thanks for the question.
Good question. Sir?
Thank you. And thank you, Simon. Please do keep creating your beautifully ingenious projects. It's I'd much rather watch you than Strictly or something like that, personally.
Oh, you're too kind. I'll give you the fiver, yeah.
I'm fascinated. It's a simple question, really, but do you actually have a favourite place that you've been to in the world? A bit cliche, I know, but...
No, it's a question you think about yourself in a way. And we try and reduce things down. I'd struggle, in total honesty. I mean, I've got a place that comes to mind, but it's not for the normal reasons, because personally, I love travelling. I think what an extraordinary place is, very inspiring. And I love travelling. I love looking at the brochures because I think what they're offering is memories and experiences as much as anything. You know, we're all tottering down a pier in life. We don't have long. What travel can give you is just the most incredible and memorable experiences. So for me, I look for places or I've enjoyed places the most, which have really tweaked my buttons, quite frankly. So I'm going to say Somaliland to you in the Horn of Africa, which is a really incredible place with really inspiring people. It's definitely, I don't doubt people I'm sure will send you from here, but you know, it's an unrecognized country with people who've built it from nothing, from the ashes of war, but amazing folk in a very, very difficult part of the world. And they've got an incredible story, you know, unrecognized country, but women in parliament, traffic lights, a minister for tourism, peace, relative peace and security, their own currency, national anthem, flag at the airport, stamping the passport. They're not on any map, no seat at the UN, and they're in a very dangerous part of planet Earth with neighbouring Somalia that's very difficult and dangerous, and where I was able to buy a diplomatic passport in my own name from a man called Mr. Bigbeard. You know, it's a weird area, but they've built something amazing there, and I love them for it. I met some of the most incredible people I've ever met there. So often in those chaotic situations, you meet the most extraordinary people, and that's what I really remember from my travels. I mean, yes to the beautiful places as well, but you know.
Where are we now? Just gentlemen here, please. Thank you.
You're sort of tentatively raising your hand there, aren't you?
Thanks. Well, what would you like to do next? I mean, you've been to many countries more than anyone else, probably. I mean, what would be challenging for you career-wise to do or to think about in terms of writing or traveling or looking at new ideas?
Well, thank you for the question. I haven't travelled to more than anybody else. I mean, you get an event like this, there will be people in the audience who have travelled to more places than I have. And often, I bet they'll come up, they say, oh, I bet I've been to... There's that sort of tally that people like to build up, isn't there?
There are competitions for the number of different stamps you get in your passport. I met a guy here 2 days ago that's got over 200 different national stamps in his passport.
Man,
it's taken him 40 years.
Extraordinary. Yeah. I'm a freelancer. I've always got to think about what's coming up next. I think that one of the keys for me, I have to have about 15 ideas bubbling along in some form at any one time. You just have to keep racking them up for the future, and you have to keep thinking about them. So books are taking a back seat for me at the moment for telly. I'll keep doing the telly as long as you and they will keep having me. I've got loads of ideas, and there's loads of places I would love to go. I mean, no TV travel-y type presenter in this with their salt will tell you otherwise, but there's vast areas of the planet I haven't visited that I would love to go to, and we are always coming up or trying to come up with ideas to put on your telly on a Sunday night or any other night for that matter. They're in a little pipeline and think, from my perspective, fingers crossed.
We have to close it there, unfortunately. Oh. But just tell us
last
thing. When can we expect Caribbean on our screens? Do you know when screening date is?
Well, we never know really until the last minute, but it's supposed to be on in a couple of months.
Couple of months.
Middle of March, I think. I've got a tele program on tonight about Vietnam in fact.
What time? What's that? What channel?
I don't know what time it's on. Well, I think done. Probably 8 or 9. It's called Fully the Coffee briefed. Trail. It's all about where our coffee comes from.
Brilliant. Right, we Paul, can all go home and look
thanks for
that.
Coming along.
Thank you very much,
thank you to
but
Paul
thank you,
as
Simon
well,
Reeve.
For sitting here not once but twice.
You're a good egg. Cheers.
Thank you very much.
They were brilliant, yes. I had a very, very quick question, Simon. We were talking earlier. Are you a hot climber or a cold climber kind of boy?
I like the view from the tops of mountains, and they're often pretty chilly, but my gig really seems to be in the tropics. And
we knew it, didn't
oh,
we?
I
was with
terrible
hot.
That
were
is,
you guys
you
with
know?
Hot? Yeah, we had a little bit of a take on that.
Oh, really? Well,
he's a hot kind of guy. We love it. Brilliant. Simon Reeve, everyone, and Paul Blizzard, amazing.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Cheers, Simon.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.